Every place that the sole of your foot shall tread upon, that have I given unto you, as I said unto Moses. There shall not any man be able to stand before thee all the days of thy life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with thee. I will not fail thee, nor forsake thee. Be strong and of a good courage. Joshua 1:3, 5-6. The year is approximately 1406 B.C. A nation of former slaves stands at the edge of the Promised Land, staring across the Jordan River at fortified cities with walls that seem to scrape the sky. For 40 years they've wandered in the wilderness, an entire generation dying in the desert because of one catastrophic failure of faith. Now their children stand where their parents once stood, facing the same question that paralyzed their ancestors. Do we trust God enough to take what He's promised us? But before we can understand the conquest, we need to understand the failure that preceded it. Because the story of Canaan's conquest doesn't begin with Joshua leading armies across the Jordan. It begins decades earlier with 12 spies, a terrified nation, and a promise that would be delayed for an entire generation. Moses stood at Kadesh Barnea, the southern gateway to Canaan. The people of Israel had just escaped slavery in Egypt, witnessed the parting of the Red Sea, received the law at Mount Sinai, and journeyed to the very borders of the land God had sworn to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They were supposed to walk right in. This was meant to be a quick reconnaissance mission, a simple scouting operation before the invasion. Moses selected 12 men, one leader from each tribe, to spy out the land. Among them were two names that would echo through history: Joshua, son of Nun from the tribe of Ephraim, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh from the tribe of Judah. Their mission was straightforward: survey the land, assess the cities, examine the people, and bring back a report. For 40 days, the spies traveled through Canaan. They walked through valleys and climbed mountains. They observed the Canaanite cities with their massive fortifications. They saw the Anakim descendants of ancient giants whose very existence seemed to mock Israel's military capabilities. And in the valley of Eshcol, they found grape clusters so enormous that it took two men to carry a single cluster on a pole between them. The land was everything God had promised, flowing with milk and honey, abundant and fertile beyond imagination. But when they returned to the camp, 10 of the 12 spies delivered a report that would seal the fate of an entire generation. "We went into the land to which you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey. Here is its fruit." They displayed the massive grapes, the pomegranates, the figs. The people marveled. But then came the devastating turn. "However, the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. We even saw descendants of Anak there." The crowd shifted nervously. "The Anakim giants." The spies continued their catalogue of terror. "The Amalekites live in the Negev. The Hittites, Jebusites, and Amorites live in the hill country. And the Canaanites live near the sea and along the Jordan." Panic rippled through the camp. Then Caleb stepped forward. He silenced the people and made a declaration that cut through the fear like a sword. "We should go up and take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it." But the 10 other spies doubled down on their pessimism. And here's where they crossed from caution into outright faithlessness. "We can't attack those people. They are stronger than we are. They spread a bad report. The land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there, the descendants of Anak, come from the Nephilim. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we looked the same to them." Grasshoppers. That's how they saw themselves. Not as the people God had just delivered from the most powerful empire on earth. Not as the nation that had watched Egypt's army drown in the sea. Not as the people who had eaten bread from heaven and drunk water from rocks. Grasshoppers. The camp erupted. People wept through the night. They turned against Moses and Aaron. "If only we had died in Egypt or in this wilderness! Why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt?" They actually started planning to elect a new leader and return to slavery. Think about that. They preferred the certainty of bondage to the risk of trusting God. Joshua and Caleb tore their clothes, a sign of extreme distress, and made one final appeal. "The land we passed through and explored is exceedingly good. If the Lord is pleased with us, He will lead us into that land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and will give it to us. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not be afraid of the people of the land, because we will devour them. Their protection is gone, but the Lord is with us. Do not be afraid of them." The response? The assembly talked about stoning them. That's when God intervened. The glory of the Lord appeared at the tent of meeting, and God spoke words that would echo for 40 years. "How long will these people treat me with contempt? How long will they refuse to believe in me, in spite of all the signs I have performed among them?" God proposed to strike them all with a plague and start over with Moses. But Moses interceded, and God relented. However, justice still demanded consequences. God declared that not one person of that generation, except Joshua and Caleb, would enter the promised land. Instead, they would wander in the wilderness for 40 years, 1 year for each day the spies had explored the land, until every adult who had refused to trust God had died in the desert. The 10 faithless spies, they died immediately in a plague. But the rest would spend 4 decades watching their generation slowly disappear into the sand. When the people heard this judgment, they suddenly found their courage, or rather, their presumption. "We have sinned," they said. "We will go up to the place the Lord promised." Moses warned them not to go, that God would not be with them, but they went anyway. The result was predictable and devastating. The Amalekites and Canaanites came down from the hills and crushed them, pursuing them all the way to Hormah. And so began 40 years of wandering, 40 years of funerals, 40 years of waiting for a new generation to rise, a generation that would trust God where their parents had failed. Nearly 4 decades passed. The original generation died off one by one in the wilderness, until finally, only Joshua and Caleb remained from those who had left Egypt as adults. A new generation had grown up men and women who had been children during the Exodus or who had been born in the wilderness. They had seen their parents' faithlessness punished. They had learned the hard way what it meant to trust God. As the 40 years drew to a close, Israel found itself once again at the borders of Canaan, this time east of the Jordan River, in the plains of Moab. They had already conquered the Amorite kingdoms east of the Jordan, Sihon, king of Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan, both of whom had made the fatal mistake of attacking Israel. These victories were significant. Og, in particular, was one of the last of the Rephaim, another race of giants. His bed, made of iron, measured 9 cubits long and 4 cubits wide, roughly 13 feet by 6 feet. The defeat of these kingdoms demonstrated to the new generation that the giants their parents had feared could indeed be defeated. But before the conquest could begin, Moses would have to say goodbye. God led Moses up to the top of Mount Nebo, to the summit of Pisgah, across from Jericho. From that vantage point, God showed Moses the entire promised land, from Gilead to Dan, all of Naphtali, the territory of Ephraim and Manasseh, all the land of Judah as far as the Mediterranean Sea, the Negev, and the whole region from the valley of Jericho down to Zoar. It was a supernatural vision, allowing Moses to see far beyond what natural sight would permit. This is the land I promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob when I said, I will give it to your descendants. I have let you see it with your eyes, but you will not cross over into it. Moses died there in Moab, and God himself buried him. To this day, no one knows where Moses' grave is located. He was 120 years old, yet his eyes were not weak, nor his strength gone. The people mourned for 30 days. Now the mantle of leadership fell to Joshua, the son of Nun, one of only two survivors from the generation that had left Egypt. For 40 years, he had served as Moses' aide. He had been there at the giving of the law. He had fought against the Amalekites. He had been one of only two voices calling for faith when everyone else chose fear. Now, God commissioned him directly. Moses, my servant, is dead. Now then, you and all these people, get ready to cross the Jordan River into the land I am about to give to them, to the Israelites. I will give you every place where you set your foot, as I promised Moses. Your territory will extend from the desert to Lebanon, and from the great river, the Euphrates, all the Hittite country, to the Mediterranean Sea in the west. No one will be able to stand against you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with thee. I will never leave you nor forsake you. 3 times in this commissioning, God told Joshua to be strong and courageous. The repetition wasn't accidental. Joshua was about to lead a nation of former nomads against fortified city-states with professional armies. He would need courage, not the reckless bravado of presumption, but the settled confidence that comes from trusting God's promises. God also gave Joshua a key to success. Meditate on the law, day and night. Be careful to obey everything written in it, and then he would be prosperous and successful. Victory in Canaan wouldn't come primarily through military genius, but through obedience to God's word. Joshua immediately began preparing the people. He sent officers through the camp with orders. Get your provisions ready. 3 days from now you will cross the Jordan here to go in and take possession of the land the Lord your God is giving you for your own. But first, he needed intelligence. He needed to know what they were facing. And so Joshua did what Moses had done 40 years earlier. He sent out spies. Only this time, he sent just 2. Jericho. The name would become synonymous with miraculous conquest, but at that moment, it was simply the first major obstacle. Built on a strategic mound, or tell, Jericho controlled the main pass into the central hill country of Canaan. Taking Jericho was essential. It was the key that would unlock the entire land. Archaeological excavations have revealed that ancient Jericho was a formidable fortress. The city was built on an artificial mound that rose about 70 feet above the surrounding plain. It was protected by 2 massive walls, an outer wall that was 6 feet thick and an inner wall that was 12 feet thick, separated by a space of about 15 feet. Houses were built in the gap between these walls, their rooms quite literally embedded in the fortification system. Joshua sent 2 spies into Jericho secretly. Their mission was focused and specific, not to explore the entire land as the 12 had done, but to scout Jericho itself and report on the city's defenses and the morale of its people. The spies entered Jericho and came to the house of a woman named Rahab. The text identifies her as a prostitute, or possibly an innkeeper, as the Hebrew word can carry both meanings. Either way, her house was built into the city wall, making it an ideal location for clandestine operations. Travelers could come and go without arousing as much suspicion as they might elsewhere. But someone noticed the Hebrew strangers and reported them to the king of Jericho. The king sent messengers to Rahab's house. Bring out the men who came to you and entered your house, because they have come to spy out the whole land. Here's where the story takes an unexpected turn. Rahab had hidden the spies on her roof under stalks of flax. Now she lied to protect them. Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they had come from. At dusk, when it was time to close the city gate, they left. I don't know which way they went. Go after them quickly. You may catch up with them. The king's men rushed out toward the Jordan River fords, and as soon as they left, the city gate was shut. The trap had closed, but with the pursuers on the outside and the spies safely hidden within. Before the spies lay down for the night, Rahab came up to the roof. What she said next revealed something extraordinary. The conquest of Canaan wouldn't succeed primarily because of Israel's military might, but because God himself was fighting for them, and the Canaanites knew it. "I know that the Lord has given you this land," Rahab said, "and that a great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. We have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to Sihon and Og, the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, whom you completely destroyed. When we heard of it, our hearts melted in fear, and everyone's courage failed because of you, for the Lord your God is God in heaven above and on the earth below." Think about what she's saying. For 40 years, stories of Israel's exodus had spread throughout Canaan. The Canaanites had heard about the plagues in Egypt, the parting of the Red Sea, the destruction of Pharaoh's army. They knew about the manna and the water from the rock. They had heard about the defeat of Sihon and Og, and these stories had terrorized them. The professional armies, the fortified walls, the chariots and weapons, none of it mattered, because the God of Israel had already won the psychological war. Rahab then made a request. "Now then, please swear to me by the Lord that you will show kindness to my family, because I have shown kindness to you. Give me a sure sign that you will spare the lives of my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and that you will save us from death." The spies agreed. They gave her specific instructions. "When we invade the land, you must tie this scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down, and you must bring your father and mother, your brothers, and all your family into your house. If any of them go outside your house into the street, their blood will be on their own heads. We will not be responsible. As for those who are in the house with you, their blood will be on our head if a hand is laid on them. But if you tell what we are doing, we will be released from the oath you made us swear." A scarlet cord, a mark of salvation. Everyone under that sign would be protected when judgment fell. The symbolism is impossible to miss. Like the blood on the doorposts in Egypt, the scarlet cord would mark a house of deliverance in a city marked for destruction. Rahab let the spies down by a rope through her window, and they escaped into the hill country, hiding there for 3 days until the pursuers returned to the city. Then they crossed back to Joshua and reported, "The Lord has surely given the whole land into our hands. All the people are melting in fear because of us." The intelligence was clear. Canaan was ripe for conquest. The enemy was already defeated in their hearts. All that remained was for Israel to walk in faith where their parents had walked in fear. 3 days after the spies returned, the officers went through the camp, announcing that when the people saw the Ark of the Covenant moving forward, carried by the Levitical priests, they were to follow it. But they were to maintain a distance of about 1,000 yards, roughly half a mile, between themselves and the Ark. This wasn't just reverence, it was practical. The people needed to be able to see the Ark clearly, as they had never been this way before. The Ark would be their guide into uncharted territory. Joshua addressed the nation. "Consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do amazing things among you." The next morning, God spoke to Joshua. "Today I will begin to exalt you in the eyes of all Israel, so they may know that I am with you as I was with Moses. Tell the priests who carry the Ark of the Covenant, when you reach the edge of the Jordan's waters, go and stand in the river." This was the test. The Jordan River at harvest time, which was when they were crossing, was at flood stage, overflowing its banks. The river could be anywhere from 90 to 100 feet wide and deep enough to drown a man. There were no bridges, no boats, and no engineering solutions, just a direct command to walk into the water. Joshua gathered the people and made an announcement that must have sent chills down their spines. "Come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God. This is how you will know that the living God is among you, and that he will certainly drive out before you the Canaanites, Hittites, Hivites, Perizzites, Girgashites, Amorites, and Jebusites. See, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth will go into the Jordan ahead of you. Now then, choose 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one from each tribe. And as soon as the priests who carry the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, set foot in the Jordan, its waters flowing downstream will be cut off and stand up in a heap." The moment of truth arrived. The priests carrying the ark stepped into the Jordan River. And the instant their feet touched the water's edge, the river stopped flowing. Upstream, at a town called Adam, near Zarethan, about 15 miles north, the water piled up in a heap. Downstream, the water flowed on to the Dead Sea until the riverbed was completely dry. The priests carrying the ark stood on dry ground in the middle of the Jordan while all Israel crossed over. 40,000 armed men crossed over before the Lord, ready for battle, onto the plains of Jericho. It was a perfect echo of the Red Sea crossing, but this time a new generation crossed with faith instead of fear. As the people crossed, Joshua commanded 12 men, one from each tribe, to go back to the middle of the Jordan where the priests were standing, and each take up a stone and carry it on their shoulders to the other side. These stones would become a memorial, a physical reminder for future generations. When children would ask, "What do these stones mean?" their parents would tell them, "Israel crossed the Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the Jordan before you until you had crossed over. The entire nation crossed men, women, children, livestock. And then Joshua set up the 12 stones at Gilgal as a permanent monument. The priests carrying the ark came up out of the river, and no sooner had their feet touched dry land than the Jordan returned to flood stage. They had crossed over. After 40 years of wandering, after a generation of death in the desert, after centuries of waiting for God's promise to Abraham to be fulfilled, Israel was finally in the promised land. But before the conquest could begin, there was one more crucial step. At Gilgal, God commanded Joshua to circumcise all the Israelite males. This might seem like strange timing. Why perform surgery that would temporarily incapacitate your fighting men just as you're about to launch a military campaign? But the reasoning reveals something profound about the nature of the conquest. During the 40 years in the wilderness, the people had stopped practicing circumcision. An entire generation had grown up without the physical sign of God's covenant with Abraham. Before they could take the land, before they could function as God's covenant people, that relationship had to be renewed. So Joshua made flint knives and circumcised the males at a place that came to be called Gibeath Haraloth, which means the Hill of Foreskins. After the circumcision, the men remained in the camp until they healed. God said to Joshua, "Today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you." The place was therefore called Gilgal, which sounds like the Hebrew word for roll. They celebrated Passover on the plains of Jericho on the 14th day of the month, exactly 40 years after the first Passover in Egypt. The very next day, they ate some of the produce of the land, unleavened bread and roasted grain. And the day after that, the manna stopped. For 40 years, God had provided bread from heaven every single day. Now that they were in the land, the miraculous provision ceased. They would eat from the fruit of Canaan. They would eat what they conquered. Then something remarkable happened. Joshua was near Jericho when he looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword. Joshua approached him and asked, "Are you for us or for our enemies?" The figure replied, "Neither, but as commander of the army of the Lord I have now come." Joshua immediately understood. This wasn't a man, this was a theophany, a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ himself, the true commander of Israel's armies. Joshua fell face down in reverence and asked, "What message does my Lord have for his servant?" The commander of the Lord's army replied, "Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy." It was the same command God had given Moses at the burning bush. Joshua was receiving his final commissioning, a reminder that the conquest of Canaan would not be accomplished by human strength or wisdom, but by the direct intervention of the Lord of hosts, who would fight for Israel. The conquest was about to begin, and it would begin with the impossible. Jericho was locked down tight. No one could enter or leave. The city had pulled up the drawbridge. So to speak, everyone was terrified of Israel. The fortifications looked impregnable. The strategy seemed impossible. Then God gave Joshua the battle plan, and it was unlike any military strategy in the history of warfare. "See, I have delivered Jericho into your hands, along with its king and its fighting men. March around the city once with all the armed men. Do this for 6 days. Have 7 priests carry trumpets of ram's horns in front of the ark. On the 7th day, march around the city 7 times, with the priests blowing the trumpets. When you hear them sound a long blast on the trumpets, have the whole army give a loud shout. Then the wall of the city will collapse, and the army will go up, everyone straight in." This wasn't a siege. This wasn't a battering ram assault. This wasn't even psychological warfare in the traditional sense. This was a liturgical procession that would end in divine demolition. For 6 days, Israel marched around Jericho once each day in complete silence, except for the sound of the ram's horn trumpets. Picture the scene from inside the city. The defenders on the walls watching this bizarre ritual, the armed men of Israel marching in formation, the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant, and the trumpets blaring. No taunts, no threats, no demands for surrender, just the steady, ominous march around the city. What were the people of Jericho thinking? Every day for 6 days, they watched this strange procession. Perhaps some laughed nervously. Perhaps others felt the dread growing. Rahab, watching from her window with the scarlet cord hanging in plain sight, must have held her breath and prayed to the God of Israel. On the 7th day, everything changed. Israel rose at dawn and began marching around the city, not once, but 7 times. On the 7th circuit, when the priests sounded the trumpet blast, Joshua commanded the army, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city." The whole army gave a great shout, and the walls collapsed. Not just one section, the entire fortification system came down. Archaeological evidence from various Canaanite sites shows evidence of destruction layers from this period, including collapsed mud brick walls. The Israelite army went straight in, each man going up into the city directly from where he stood. The city was completely destroyed under the ban of Hiram, total devotion to God, which meant total destruction. Everything living was killed except Rahab and her family. All the silver, gold, and articles of bronze and iron were taken into the treasury of the Lord's house. Everything else was burned. Joshua pronounced a curse on anyone who would attempt to rebuild Jericho. "Cursed before the Lord is the one who undertakes to rebuild this city, Jericho. At the cost of his firstborn son, he will lay its foundations. At the cost of his youngest, he will set up its gates." That curse would be fulfilled centuries later when a man named Hiel of Bethel rebuilt Jericho in the days of King Ahab and lost his firstborn and youngest sons, just as Joshua had declared. But for now, the message was clear. Jericho was a first fruit offering to God, a demonstration that the entire conquest would be accomplished by his power, not by Israel's military might. As for Rahab, She was brought out safely with all her family and lived among the Israelites. Remarkably, she would later marry an Israelite named Salmon and become an ancestor of King David and ultimately of Jesus Christ himself. A Canaanite prostitute who exercised faith became part of the messianic line. The report of Jericho's fall spread throughout Canaan, and terror gripped the hearts of its inhabitants. The fortress city that guarded the gateway to the land had fallen without a single casualty on Israel's side. If Jericho could fall, nowhere was safe. But victory can be more dangerous than defeat. And Israel was about to learn that lesson the hard way. With Jericho destroyed, Joshua set his sights on the next target, a small city called Ai, located near Bethel in the hill country. Joshua sent spies to reconnoiter Ai, and they returned with a confident report, "Not all the army will have to go up against Ai. Send 2,000 or 3,000 men to take it, and do not weary the whole army, for only a few people live there." So about 3,000 men went up to attack Ai. It should have been an easy victory, a small mop-up operation after the miraculous triumph at Jericho. Instead, it was a disaster. The men of Ai routed the Israelite forces, chasing them from the city gate as far as the stone quarries and striking them down on the slopes. The Israelites lost 36 men, not a massive number by ancient warfare standards, but after the miraculous victory at Jericho, even one casualty was shocking. More importantly, the hearts of the people melted in fear and became like water. Joshua tore his clothes and fell face down before the ark of the Lord, remaining there until evening along with the elders of Israel, throwing dust on their heads in anguish. Joshua cried out to God, "Alas, sovereign Lord, why did you ever bring this people across the Jordan to deliver us into the hands of the Amorites to destroy us? If only we had been content to stay on the other side of the Jordan. Pardon your servant, Lord. What can I say now that Israel has been routed by its enemies? The Canaanites and the other people of the country will hear about this, and they will surround us and wipe out our name from the earth. What then will you do for your own great name?" The Lord said to Joshua, "Stand up! What are you doing down on your face? Israel has sinned. They have violated my covenant, which I commanded them to keep. They have taken some of the devoted things. They have stolen. They have lied. They have put them with their own possessions. That is why the Israelites cannot stand against their enemies. They turn their backs and run, because they have been made liable to destruction. I will not be with you any more unless you destroy whatever among you is devoted to destruction." Someone had violated the harem, the total devotion to God of everything in Jericho. Someone had taken what was meant for God alone. And that sin had broken Israel's covenant relationship with God, making victory impossible. Joshua was commanded to consecrate the people and bring them forward by tribes, then by clans, then by families, and finally man by man. Through a process that likely involved the sacred lots called Urim and Thummim, God would identify the guilty party. The next morning, the whole process began. The tribe of Judah was taken, then the clan of the Zerahites, then the family of Zimri. Finally, man by man, the family was brought forward until one man stood alone, Achan, son of Carmi. Joshua said to him, "My son, give glory to the Lord, the God of Israel, and honor him. Tell me what you have done. Do not hide it from me." Achan's confession came tumbling out. "It is true. I have sinned against the Lord, the God of Israel. This is what I have done. When I saw in the plunder a beautiful robe from Babylonia, 200 shekels of silver and a bar of gold weighing 50 shekels, I coveted them and took them. They are hidden in the ground inside my tent with the silver underneath." Joshua sent messengers who ran to Achan's tent and found everything exactly as he had described, with the silver buried underneath. They brought the items to Joshua and all the Israelites and spread them out before the Lord. The sentence was swift and severe. Joshua and all Israel took Achan, the silver, the robe, the gold bar, his sons and daughters, his cattle, donkeys, sheep, his tent, and everything he owned to the valley of Achor. Joshua said, "Why have you brought this trouble on us? The Lord will bring trouble on you today." All Israel stoned Achan and his family, then burned their bodies and everything they owned. Over them they heaped up a large pile of rocks that remains to this day. The place is still called the Valley of Achor, the Valley of Trouble. The judgment seems harsh by modern standards, but it reveals several critical truths. First, sin is never private. Achan's sin affected the entire nation, causing the death of 36 men at Ai. Second, covenant violation has consequences. Third, the conquest of Canaan wasn't just a military campaign. It was a holy war where Israel functioned as God's instrument of judgment. Disobedience couldn't be tolerated because it undermined the entire spiritual foundation of the conquest. With the sin removed, God told Joshua, "Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. Take the whole army with you and go up and attack Ai. For I have delivered into your hands the king of Ai, his people, his city, and his land." This time, Joshua took no chances. He devised a careful military strategy involving an ambush. He sent 30,000 of his best fighting men out by night to set an ambush behind the city. The main force would attack from the front, then feign retreat, drawing the men of Ai out to pursue them. When the city was left vulnerable, the ambush force would attack from behind and set the city on fire. The plan worked perfectly. The king of Ai and his army came out to meet Israel in battle, and Joshua and his men retreated toward the wilderness as planned. All the men of Ai were called out to pursue them, leaving the city undefended. The ambush force rose quickly from their position, rushed into the city, captured it, and set it on fire. When the men of Ai looked back and saw smoke billowing from their city, they had no chance to escape. The Israelites, who had been retreating, turned back against them, and the ambush force came out from the city against them. The men of Ai were caught in the middle, with Israel on both sides. They were cut down until no survivors or fugitives remained. 12,000 men and women fell that day, the entire population of Ai. Only the king of Ai was taken alive, brought to Joshua, and then hanged on a pole until evening. At sunset, Joshua ordered his body taken down and thrown at the entrance of the city gate, and a large pile of rocks was heaped over it, another memorial to God's justice. Unlike Jericho, the Israelites were allowed to take the livestock and plunder from Ai as spoils of war. The city itself was burned and left as a permanent ruin, becoming a heap of ruins, desolate to this day. After the victory at Ai, Joshua led Israel north to Mount Ebal, where Moses had commanded them to build an altar. Using uncut stones that no iron tool had touched, they built an altar to the Lord and offered burnt offerings and fellowship offerings. There, in the presence of all Israel, Joshua copied on stones the law of Moses, likely a copy of the Ten Commandments, or perhaps key portions of the covenant law. Then, in one of the most dramatic scenes of the conquest, all Israel with their elders, officials, and judges stood on both sides of the Ark of the Covenant, facing the Levitical priests who carried it. Half the people stood in front of Mount Gerizim and half in front of Mount Ebal, just as Moses had commanded. These two mountains formed a natural amphitheater with remarkable acoustics, making it possible for Joshua's voice to carry to the assembled multitude. Joshua read all the words of the law, the blessings and the curses, exactly as written in the book of the law. There was not a word of all that Moses had commanded that Joshua did not read to the whole assembly of Israel, including the women and children and the foreigners living among them. This covenant renewal ceremony was crucial. It reminded Israel that the conquest was not about land grabbing or imperial expansion. It was about God fulfilling his promises to Abraham while simultaneously executing judgment on the Canaanites for their sins sins that had reached full measure after centuries of patience. Israel's success depended entirely on covenant faithfulness. Obey God, and victory was assured. Disobey, and defeat was inevitable. But even as Israel renewed their covenant at Shechem, a group of Canaanites was planning a deception that would have lasting consequences. News of Israel's victories at Jericho and Ai spread like wildfire through Canaan. The kings west of the Jordan in the hill country, in the western foothills, and along the entire coast of the Mediterranean Sea as far north as Lebanon, heard what had happened. These included the kings of the Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. Their response was to unite and make war against Joshua and Israel. But the inhabitants of Gibeon, one of the Hivite cities, chose a different strategy. Gibeon was no minor settlement. The text describes it as an important city, like one of the royal cities. It was larger than Ai, and all its men were good fighters. Yet the Gibeonites recognized what many more powerful cities did not. Fighting against the God of Israel was futile. So they resorted to deception. The Gibeonites dressed themselves as if they had traveled from a far country. They loaded their donkeys with worn and patched wineskins, put on worn-out and patched sandals, and dressed in ragged clothes. They took dry and moldy bread and traveled to the Israelite camp at Gilgal. When they arrived, they told Joshua and the Israelites, "We have come from a distant country. Make a treaty with us." The Israelites were immediately suspicious. "But perhaps you live near us?" they said. "How then can we make a treaty with you?" The Gibeonites persisted. "We are your servants." They told an elaborate story about how they had heard reports of the fame of the Lord and all that he had done in Egypt and to the two Amorite kings east of the Jordan. They claimed their elders and all those living in their country had sent them with instructions to make a treaty with Israel. "This bread of ours was warm when we packed it at home on the day we left to come to you. But now see how dry and moldy it is. And these wineskins that we filled were new, but see how cracked they are. And our clothes and sandals are worn out by the very long journey." It was a convincing performance. The Israelites examined their provisions, the bread, the wineskins, the worn clothing. Everything appeared to confirm their story. Then the text reveals the critical mistake. The Israelites sampled their provisions, but did not inquire of the Lord. Joshua made a treaty of peace with them, guaranteeing their safety, and the leaders of the assembly ratified it by oath. They made a covenant before God that they would not harm the Gibeonites. 3 days later, the truth came out. The Israelites discovered that the Gibeonites were actually neighbors, living nearby. The whole assembly grumbled against the leaders who had made the oath, but the leaders responded, "We have given them our oath by the Lord, the God of Israel, and we cannot touch them now." The leaders decided that the Gibeonites would live, but as punishment for their deception, they would become woodcutters and water carriers for the entire community and for the altar of the Lord. When Joshua confronted the Gibeonites about their deception, they replied, "Your servants were clearly told how the Lord your God had commanded his servant Moses to give you the whole land and to wipe out all its inhabitants from before you. So we feared for our lives because of you, and that is why we did this. We are now in your hands. Do to us whatever seems good and right to you." Joshua honored the treaty, but imposed the sentence. The Gibeonites would serve as perpetual servants at the house of God. Interestingly, this decision meant that a Canaanite people would survive within Israel, living among them for generations. Centuries later, King Saul would violate this oath and attempt to annihilate the Gibeonites, bringing a 3-year famine on Israel during David's reign. Even after all that time, God still held Israel accountable for the oath Joshua had made. The Gibeonite deception teaches an important lesson. Even in the midst of miraculous victories, the people of God must seek His guidance in every decision. Appearances can be deceiving. Human wisdom is insufficient. The conquest required not just military courage, but constant dependence on God's direction. And that dependence would be tested again, almost immediately, when five Amorite kings decided to punish Gibeon for making peace with Israel. The news that Gibeon had made peace with Israel sent shockwaves through Canaan. Gibeon wasn't just any city, it was a major population center with skilled warriors. Its defection to Israel was a devastating blow to the Canaanite alliance. Five Amorite kings, Adoni-Zedek, king of Jerusalem, Hoham, king of Hebron, Piram, king of Jarmuth, Japhia, king of Lachish, and Debir, king of Eglon, formed a coalition. Rather than attack Israel directly, they decided to make an example of Gibeon. They marched up with all their troops and took up positions against Gibeon, laying siege to it. The Gibeonites sent an urgent message to Joshua at the camp in Gilgal. "Do not abandon your servants. Come up to us quickly and save us. Help us, because all the Amorite kings from the hill country have joined forces against us." Joshua now faced a dilemma. The Gibeonites had deceived him, but he had made a covenant with them before God. Would he honor that covenant, even though it had been obtained through deception? Without hesitation, Joshua gathered his entire army, including all his best fighting men, and marched from Gilgal to Gibeon, a journey of about 20 miles that they apparently completed overnight. The Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid of them. I have given them into your hand. Not one of them will be able to withstand you." Joshua's forces arrived at dawn, catching the five-king coalition completely by surprise. The Lord threw the Amorite armies into confusion before Israel, and Joshua inflicted massive casualties at Gibeon. He pursued them along the road going up to Beth-horon and cut them down all the way to Azekah and Makkedah. As they fled before Israel, something extraordinary happened. The Lord hurled large hailstones down on them from the sky, and more died from the hail than from the swords of the Israelites. God Himself was fighting for Israel, using the very elements of creation as weapons against His enemies. But Joshua needed more time. The enemy was routed, but they were escaping under cover of approaching darkness. If night fell, the coalition forces might regroup or escape to their fortified cities. So Joshua did something unprecedented. He prayed for a miracle, and he did it publicly, in the sight of Israel. "Sun, stand still over Gibeon, and you, moon, over the valley of Aijalon." And the text records what happened next. "The sun stood still and the moon stopped, till the nation avenged itself on its enemies. The sun stopped in the middle of the sky and delayed going down about a full day. There has never been a day like it before or since, a day when the Lord listened to a human being. Surely the Lord was fighting for Israel." Scholars and theologians have debated for centuries exactly what happened that day. Did the earth stop rotating? Did God create a localized optical phenomenon? Did He supernaturally extend the daylight? The text doesn't explain the mechanism. It simply states the result. The sun delayed going down for about a full day, giving Israel time to complete the destruction of their enemies. The five kings themselves fled and hid in a cave at Makkedah. When Joshua was told where they were hiding, he ordered large rocks to be rolled against the mouth of the cave and guards posted at the entrance. Meanwhile, Joshua commanded the army to continue pursuing the enemy, not letting them reach their fortified cities. After the battle, Joshua returned to the cave at Makkedah. He ordered the cave opened and the five kings brought out. In front of all Israel, Joshua had his commanders put their feet on the necks of these kings, a symbolic act demonstrating complete victory and dominance. Then Joshua said to his commanders, "Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. Be strong and courageous. This is what the Lord will do to all the enemies you are going to fight. After that, Joshua put the five kings to death and exposed their bodies on five poles until evening. At sunset, their bodies were taken down and thrown into the cave where they had hidden, and large rocks were placed at the mouth of the cave. The victory at Gibeon broke the back of Canaanite resistance in the southern hill country. With one decisive battle, Israel had defeated a coalition of five major city-states. The way was now open for the conquest of the south. From Gibeon, Joshua systematically conquered the southern region of Canaan in a swift campaign. The text provides a rapid-fire account of city after city falling before Israel's advance. That same day, Joshua captured Makeda and put it to the sword, totally destroying everyone in it and leaving no survivors. He did to the king of Makeda as he had done to the king of Jericho. Then Joshua and all Israel moved on to Libna and attacked it. The Lord gave that city and its king into Israel's hand. Joshua put it to the sword and left no survivors. From Libna, they moved on to Lachish, one of the most important fortress cities in Canaan. They laid siege to it and attacked it. The Lord gave Lachish into Israel's hand, and Joshua captured it on the second day. During the siege, Horam, king of Gezer, came up to help Lachish, but Joshua defeated him and his army as well. From Lachish, Joshua moved on to Eglon. They took it that same day and totally destroyed everyone in it, just as they had done to Lachish. Then Joshua and all Israel went up from Eglon to Hebron. Hebron was one of the oldest cities in Canaan, built 7 years before the Egyptian city of Zoan. It was associated with Abraham, who had lived there centuries earlier. They captured Hebron and put it to the sword together with its king, its villages, and everyone in it, leaving no survivors. From Hebron they turned back to Debir and attacked it, capturing it, its king, and its villages. They totally destroyed everyone in it, leaving no survivors. The campaign was devastatingly effective. Joshua subdued the whole region from Kadesh Barnea to Gaza and from the whole region of Goshen to Gibeon. He captured all these kings and their lands in one campaign because the Lord, the God of Israel, fought for Israel. Then Joshua returned with all Israel to the camp at Gilgal. The southern coalition had been completely destroyed, but the northern kings, hearing what had happened, began forming their own alliance. The northern campaign and the battle at the waters of Merom. When Jabin, king of Hazor, heard of Israel's victories, he sent word to multiple northern kings. Jobab, king of Madon, the kings of Shimron and Akshaph, the northern kings in the mountains, in the Arabah south of Kinnereth, in the western foothills, and in Naphoth Dor on the west. He contacted the Canaanites in the east and west, the Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, and Jebusites in the hill country, and the Hivites below Hermon in the region of Mizpah. The army that assembled was massive, a force described as numerous as the sand on the seashore, with vast numbers of horses and chariots. All these kings joined forces and made camp together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. This was the most formidable military force Israel had yet faced. Chariots were the ancient world's equivalent of tanks, devastating weapons that could break infantry formations and strike terror into foot soldiers. Israel had no chariots. They were former slaves and wilderness wanderers facing a professional chariot corps. The Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid of them, because by this time tomorrow I will hand all of them slain over to Israel. You are to hamstring their horses and burn their chariots." Joshua and his whole army came against them suddenly at the waters of Merom and attacked. The Lord gave them into the hand of Israel, who defeated them and pursued them to Greater Sidon, to Misrephoth-Maim, and to the valley of Mizpah on the east. The Israelites struck them down, leaving no survivors. Joshua did to them as the Lord had directed. He hamstrung their horses and burned their chariots. This was significant. Joshua didn't keep the chariots for Israel's own use. as would have been militarily sensible. God wanted Israel to trust in him, not in military technology. At that time, Joshua turned back and captured Hazor, striking down its king with the sword. Hazor was the head of all these kingdoms, the most important city-state in northern Canaan. Archaeological excavations have revealed that ancient Hazor covered about 200 acres and housed a population of perhaps 20,000 people, making it one of the largest cities in ancient Canaan. Its destruction marked the collapse of Canaanite power in the north. Israel captured all these royal cities and their kings and put them to the sword, totally destroying them. They burned Hazor itself, but they did not burn any of the cities built on their mounds except Hazor. This detail is archaeologically significant. The Hebrew term for these cities is tel, artificial mounds created by successive layers of habitation. By not burning these cities, Israel could occupy them immediately rather than having to rebuild. So Joshua took the entire land according to all that the Lord had spoken to Moses. He gave it as an inheritance to Israel according to their tribal divisions. Then the land had rest from war. But the conquest wasn't completely finished. While the major Canaanite coalitions had been defeated and the power of the city-states broken, pockets of resistance remained. The text makes this clear in its summary of what had been accomplished. The book of Joshua provides two lists that help us understand the scope of the conquest. First, it catalogues the kings that Moses had defeated east of the Jordan: Sihon, king of the Amorites, and Og, king of Bashan. Then it lists the 31 kings west of the Jordan that Joshua defeated, from the king of Jericho to the king of Tirzah. 31 kings in the western campaign alone. But here's what's crucial to understand. These weren't kings in the sense of rulers of vast empires. These were city-state kings, rulers of individual cities and their surrounding territories. Canaan was not a unified nation, but a patchwork of independent city-states, each with its own king, often in rivalry with each other. The conquest strategy was brilliant. By defeating the coalitions and destroying the major fortress cities, Joshua broke the organized military resistance. The Canaanite city-state system collapsed, but complete occupation and settlement would take much longer. Joshua himself, in his old age, acknowledged this. The Lord said to him, "You are now very old, and there are still very large areas of land to be taken over." These included all the regions of the Philistines and Geshurites, the land of the Canaanites from the Shihor River in Egypt to the territory of Ekron in the north, all the Lebanese territories, and much of the northern region. The conquest had three phases. First, a swift military campaign that broke organized Canaanite resistance. Second, a period of gradual occupation as the tribes settled their allotted territories. And third, ongoing conflicts with remaining Canaanite populations and with new threats like the Philistines. The book of Judges makes it clear that many Canaanites remained in the land. The tribes of Israel often failed to drive them out completely. Some Canaanite cities, like Jerusalem, remained unconquered for centuries until David finally took them. This incomplete conquest would have lasting consequences, as the remaining Canaanite populations became a snare to Israel, leading them into idolatry and covenant unfaithfulness. With the major military campaigns completed, Joshua began the process of dividing the conquered territories among the tribes of Israel. This wasn't a random distribution, but the fulfillment of promises made centuries earlier. The tribes of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh had already received their inheritance east of the Jordan during Moses' time. They had requested this territory because they had large herds and flocks, and the land was suitable for livestock. Moses had granted their request on the condition that their fighting men would cross the Jordan with the rest of Israel and help conquer the western territories. They had fulfilled that promise, fighting alongside their brothers throughout the conquest. Now, Joshua released them to return to their lands east of the Jordan, blessing them with these words: Return to your homes with your great wealth, with large herds of livestock, with silver, gold, bronze, and iron, and a great quantity of clothing, and divide the plunder from your enemies with your fellow Israelites. For the remaining 9.5 tribes, the land west of the Jordan was divided by lot, as the Lord had commanded through Moses. The process took place at Shiloh, where the tent of meeting had been set up. This wasn't arbitrary. Casting lots was understood as a way of discerning God's will. The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord, says the book of Proverbs. Judah received the southern region, a large and important territory that included the cities of Hebron, Debir, and eventually Jerusalem, though Jerusalem wasn't conquered until David's reign. Within Judah's territory, Caleb received a special inheritance, Hebron, the city he had spied out 45 years earlier. At 85 years old, Caleb was still vigorous and declared, "I am still as strong today as the day Moses sent me out. I'm just as vigorous to go out to battle now as I was then." Ephraim and the western half-tribe of Manasseh, the tribes descended from Joseph, received the central hill country. Their territories included some of the most fertile and strategically important land in Canaan. Shiloh, where the tabernacle was located, was in Ephraim's territory. Benjamin received a small but strategically crucial territory between Judah and Ephraim, including the area around Jericho and later Jerusalem, which sat on the border between Benjamin and Judah. The remaining tribes, Simeon, Zebulun, Issachar, Asher, Naphtali, and Dan, received their allotments in various regions. Simeon's territory was actually within Judah's borders, fulfilling Jacob's prophecy that Simeon would be scattered in Israel. Dan's original allotment was in the coastal plain, but they would later migrate north because they couldn't drive out the Amorites from their territory. Special provisions were made for the Levites. They received no large tribal territory, but instead were given 48 cities scattered throughout all the tribal lands, along with pasture lands for their flocks. This distribution fulfilled God's plan for the Levites to live among all the tribes, serving as priests and teachers of the law. 6 of these Levitical cities were designated as cities of refuge, 3 on each side of the Jordan. These were places where someone who had accidentally killed another person could flee for protection from the Avenger of Blood, the victim's family member responsible for executing justice. The person would receive a fair trial before the assembly, and if the killing was indeed accidental rather than premeditated, they could live safely in the city of refuge until the death of the current high priest, at which point they could return home without fear of vengeance. Joshua himself received a personal inheritance, the city of Timnath-Serah, in the hill country of Ephraim, which he rebuilt and lived in. It was a modest inheritance for the man who had led the conquest, reflecting his character as a faithful servant rather than a power-hungry conqueror. The distribution of the land was meticulous and fair, guided by the lots cast before the Lord. Each tribe received an inheritance, fulfilling God's ancient promise to Abraham that his descendants would possess the land from the river of Egypt to the great river Euphrates. Many years passed. Joshua grew old and advanced in years. Knowing his death was approaching, he gathered all Israel, their elders, leaders, judges, and officials, and addressed them with words that would echo through the centuries. He reminded them of everything God had done. "I brought your ancestors out of Egypt, and you came to the sea. The Egyptians pursued them with chariots and horsemen as far as the Red Sea. But they cried to the Lord for help, and he put darkness between you and the Egyptians. He brought the sea over them and covered them." He recounted the wilderness journey, the defeat of the Amorite kings east of the Jordan, and the conquest of Canaan. "I gave you a land on which you did not toil and cities you did not build, and you live in them and eat from vineyards and olive groves that you did not plant." Then came the challenge. "Now fear the Lord and serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods your ancestors worshipped beyond the Euphrates River and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, Then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your ancestors served beyond the Euphrates, or the gods of the Amorites, in whose land you are living. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord." This is one of the most famous declarations in Scripture, a clear, uncompromising statement of covenant loyalty. Joshua wasn't making suggestions. He was demanding a decision. Neutrality wasn't an option. Every person had to choose whom they would serve. The people responded, "Far be it from us to forsake the Lord to serve other gods. It was the Lord our God Himself who brought us and our parents up out of Egypt, from that land of slavery, and performed those great signs before our eyes. He protected us on our entire journey and among all the nations through which we traveled. And the Lord drove out before us all the nations, including the Amorites who lived in the land. We too will serve the Lord, because He is our God." But Joshua pressed them, "You are not able to serve the Lord. He is a holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your rebellion and your sins. If you forsake the Lord and serve foreign gods, He will turn and bring disaster on you and make an end of you after He has been good to you." It seems like a strange thing to say. Why tell the people they're not able to serve God? Joshua wanted them to understand the seriousness of the commitment they were making. Serving God wasn't casual or convenient. It required total loyalty, complete obedience, and wholehearted devotion. It would cost them everything. The people insisted, "No, we will serve the Lord." Joshua replied, "You are witnesses against yourselves that you have chosen to serve the Lord." "Yes, we are witnesses," they replied. "Now then," said Joshua, "throw away the foreign gods that are among you and yield your hearts to the Lord, the God of Israel." The fact that Joshua had to tell them to throw away foreign gods reveals a disturbing truth. Even after everything they had witnessed, the plagues in Egypt, the parting of the Red Sea, the manna in the wilderness, the Jordan River stopping, the walls of Jericho falling, the sun standing still, some Israelites were still holding on to idols. The pull of idolatry was that strong. The people declared, "We will serve the Lord our God and obey Him." On that day, Joshua made a covenant for the people and set up a statute and an ordinance for them at Shechem. He took a large stone and set it up there under the oak, near the holy place of the Lord. He said to all the people, "See, this stone will be a witness against us. It has heard all the words the Lord has said to us. It will be a witness against you if you are untrue to your God." Then Joshua dismissed the people, each to their own inheritance. Not long after, Joshua died at the age of 110 years. He was buried in his own inheritance at Timnath-Serah in the hill country of Ephraim. And the bones of Joseph, which the Israelites had brought up from Egypt, were buried at Shechem in the tract of land Jacob had purchased. The Exodus generation had finally been laid to rest in the promised land. The text concludes with a haunting summary. Israel served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and of the elders who outlived him, and who had experienced everything the Lord had done for Israel. That last phrase, "throughout the lifetime of Joshua," hangs in the air like an unspoken warning. What would happen after Joshua and those elders died? Would the next generation maintain covenant faithfulness? Or would they forget what God had done and turn to the gods of Canaan? The book of Judges provides the answer, and it's not encouraging. But that's another story.